So thanks for, first I should probably ask, is there somebody here who's supposed to introduce me? I don't think there is, but I don't want to steal anyone's thunder. Okay, good. I'll introduce myself. I'm Matt Reason. I'm from Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Boy, I just turned Twitter notifications off on my phone while I'm doing this. And welcome to Responsive Web Design for a Library. Hello, Andrew. Excited. I feel like I'm staring at my Twitter screen right now. Bear with me. So anyway, thanks for coming down. And the first thing I want to say is there's a lot of other stuff going on at ALA, like a lot. And I am recording this right now, and I always put my talk up online. My slides are always up. You can tweet me or email me any questions you have. So if you're really on the fence about something else, feel free to go to that. You can always watch this later. So now we're all going to stare and see who's not. So if you really want to go, just feel free to go. There are a lot of other sessions again. So somehow that always backfires when I want to lose. Well, you've probably heard a lot about the mobile web and the desktop web, and how these are somehow different internets or something that we access in these different devices. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be in this room, is my guess. Right? So we hear a lot about the mobile web and how people use their phones for doing different things. And the general solution that we have to solving this problem of people coming to our websites on mobile devices is to create a separate mobile site, right? How many people here have a library website that starts with M dot? Yeah, okay, so maybe 30%. How many other people have a library website that has a different URL when you have a mobile website? Okay, a couple. And how many people don't have a mobile website at all? Okay, at least half, probably more. Well, this is the general solution that most people have been going to. It's been kind of the standard for last 5-6 years. And the real way to do it, this is some pseudocode, right? Is to say, all right, if the device that's visiting me equals an iPhone, or equals a Droid, or equals whatever phone you happen to have today, or one of the 8 million Android phones that just came out since I started the sentence, show the mobile site, otherwise, let's show the desktop site, right? That's kind of how it works. It's called device centric. There's a problem with this, though. There's a lot of devices out there, okay? It's kind of unscalable. This is a shot from this company, Animoca. They're an Android app developer. They currently test all of their apps on 400 different Android devices. And their number one complaint from users is that their device doesn't work right, because they only test on 400. This is a great visualization of this kind of fragmentation. This is a visualization of all the Android devices that have downloaded the OpenSignalMaps app. There's 3,997 different devices. That's just the devices on Android that have downloaded one app. So, how many of you think you have the resources in your library to keep up with all the different devices that you're going to need to detect to send people to a mobile device? I'm waiting for hands because I'm looking to see if you're higher. So there's another way to do this, right? Maybe a little bit more sane. You can do browser sniffing. You can say, well, look, you know, people who are using these particular devices are on specific browsers that identify themselves differently than desktop browsers, right? There's Mobile Safari, there's Opera Mini, there's the whatever the Firefox one is called now. They keep changing it. So we can see if they're on that browser, and then we can show them our mobile site. Well, this doesn't really work great either, right? Because you can change your browser user agent string. And plus, there's a great website if you want to go visit called, I think it's useragentstrings.com. They have a list of all the agent strings. And there's like 380 user agent strings just for Internet Explorer 7. So it's really, I mean, you do have the same problem, right? You can't, this is not scalable. But even more than that, there's this sort of idea that somehow the mobile web is different, that people do things differently on their phones than they do on a desktop, right? And therefore, that they want different things. If anybody is not following Wilco on Twitter, Matt Marquis, which is probably correct, we're going to just wait right now. Everybody just follow him. But you see this all the time, right? How many people with your mobile site, your separate mobile site, how many people have everything you can do on the desktop site available on the mobile site? One hand went up. Because we think, well, they don't want to do that on their phone, right? Now, we do this a lot when we build websites. We think we know how people want to do things. One of the things we're really bad at doing is translating what we think other people are doing to even the way that we actually operate when we're not building something, right? So how many of you have gone to a website on one of your phones since you've been here at ALA, and it was a crappy experience because either they didn't give you the option to do what you wanted to do, or you got stuck in a desktop site that you had to, you know, do a little pinch thing and kept losing it and moved, and then you, oops, I accidentally hit a link and I'm just trying to move, and, right? Anybody do that? Okay. All right. We won't vote through the whole talk. Basically, we have this idea, right, that people are, like, rushed on their phone, and they're, like, half paying attention, and they only got one hand, and they're just trying to quick, you know, get their, you know, direction to our library. But even in our own experience using our phone, you can probably tell that that's not actually always the case, right? So this is something that people call either context, right, where you are when you're using your phone, or intent, what you're trying to do. A lot of times, those things can be confused, but we essentially try to turn ourselves into mind readers and figure out what it is that people are trying to do when they come to us on the phone. We don't ever do this with desktop users, right? We never say, boy, we got to really take into account that somebody could be calling up on a 300 baud modem and a 286. You know? No one ever says that, right? Because just why would we want to mind read? I mean, you can do whatever you want in a desktop computer, right? Because mobile phones are so limited. Yeah. Things are changing. So there's a great series of studies that have come out recently that show sort of what people do with their smartphones. A lot of these numbers are actually from 2010 and 2011, so I'm sure they've changed by now. But 84% of people who own a smartphone said that they use their smartphone to access the web at home on their high-speed wireless network. So now, we can't guarantee that we're dealing with people who are on crappy 3G networks, right? So that's a hole in our idea. 80% of people said they use them during random downtime to surf the web, right? I don't have anything going on, I'm bored. I'm going to check this out. 76% while waiting in line. 64% use them at work, also on a high-speed network. 39% admit to using them in the bathroom, which basically means that 61% are liars. So people are using their phones to access the web everywhere. I actually do a lot of my web browsing laying on my couch. I get really frustrated when I can't actually access them. So the whole point here is that there really isn't a separate mobile web, right? There's a great article by Stephen Hay, linked down here at the bottom, and I have resources you can get up on the computer internet later. But he basically says, look, there's no mobile web. There is only the web, and we access it with different devices. Okay. So we have to try to think, what is the best way to solve the problems that we're facing then of all these different device sizes and, you know, our designs and all these different things. Well, the solution's been around for a long time. I mean, part of the issue is that we came to web design thinking that it was print design, right? So we all brought all the baggage that we had from print along with us to the web. And we do this with everything, right? If you look at any new medium that comes along, we always carry over all the little things that we've evolved throughout the history of the previous medium. And, you know, it takes us a while to sort of shed some of those and figure out how to get past them. So one of the problems we think of when we design for the web is we want it to look pixel perfect. I won't ask you to vote on who's actually said that or heard it.
But we've all heard it. Some of us have probably even said it. I might be guilty.
And what we want is we want every single person that comes to our site on every single device and every single browser to have the exact same look, right? We want everything to be just in pixel, you know, pixel perfect shape. So what we did at first was we used tables and we laid out all of our websites with tables. Right? No one here did that.
That was just bad. We wouldn't do that. But what we were doing was we were hoping for that control that we had over print.
But John also, in 2000, right, 12 years ago, on Wista Park was this great article, probably the thing that got me most excited about web design, called The Tao of Web Design. Which basically says, look, the control we had in print is actually a function of a limitation of the printed page, right? You're stuck with a particular size canvas that never changes. It's a limitation that we should get rid of on the web instead of trying to replicate. So we need to design for the fluidity and the flexibility that the web is capable of. This is 12 years ago. Somebody was already writing about this, and I'm now standing up here, and we're all sort of talking about this like it's a new idea, right? But John Alsop, he was there a long time ago. So what we need is a way to create sites that are flexible, that are scalable, right? We don't want to have to keep up with all this browser and device sniffing. And we need something that's responsive to our users' devices and screens and needs, right? That last word is sort of key. So enter responsive web design. Has everybody heard of it? You want me to define it? Everybody heard of it? Anybody not know what it is? I can talk about it real quickly. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about it, but the history of it is essentially a series of techniques, design techniques that were sort of packaged together as an idea called responsive design by Andy Marcotte in both an article on the website Alista Park and the conference at Event Park. And they're just a couple of simple techniques that help us to solve some of these problems of device fragmentation and browser fragmentation. So the first sort of part of the triad of responsive web design is the idea of designing a flexible grid. And this is essentially where you design your site based on a grid-based layout. So you might have a grid that has these particular dimensions. You might have some gutters that are about 24 pixels, right? Now we're pretending we're living in the age of pixels here. And then you might have your wider sections of 80 pixels. And you're going to design your site to sort of line up with this grid. So you're going to have chunks that fit in different places and that are always aligning on one of those lines. It's just a good, you know, design strategy. So let's say we design a site. We've got a couple of simple boxes, and you know, we're still using pixels here. So we're going to make our site 960 pixels. Remember when that magic number came out? Like, anybody doing web design in like 2009? And we're like, oh, we solved all the problems. 960, it's awesome. So we're going to have a grid of 960 pixels, 24 pixels gutter, 80 pixel chunks, and we're going to put two content areas. We want our little sidebar, right, a little navigation perhaps, and we're going to have our content area. And in our design that we created in Photoshop, which you can do, we've made these particular dimensions, 288 pixels for this one, which is going to encompass three of these chunks and two gutters, and then the 600 pixel chunk, which will encompass some more. And then there's some gutters in between. Now, when somebody visits that on a smaller screen, this is what they see, right? Unless their device automatically scales it super tiny so that they can't see anything that you have on your screen. So they're missing a big chunk of it. Now, especially if this is your navigation, right? They're not even seeing the stuff that they came there for, which is the content. So we want to think differently about the way that we build our grids. We don't want to use pixel-based fixed grids anymore. We want to use flexible grids. And we do that with a little bit of math. One more vote. How many people love math? Wow, people raise their hands. That's funny. I don't like math. This is pretty simple math. But basically what it is you take the target, which you can think of in most cases as the element you're dealing with, right, the width of the element, and you divide it by the context, or rather its containing element. So you're thinking of, I want to know, I want to get the percentage base of how big this element is in relation to its container. Because what we want to do is we want to make things with percentages and not pixels, because percentages are scalable, right? They're flexible, they respond to different sizes. So, if we go back to our 960 pixel layout, we have, on the one side, our little left container, a 288 pixel, that's going to be our target value. And 960 is the container that sits with it, right? So this is floated in CSS terms over to the left inside of our larger container. And likewise, the 600 pixel is going to be our target for another little formula. And we're again going to use 960 for the container. Now, be friends with this. These numbers are actually pretty tame. I was sort of disappointed when I actually did this because I was hoping they'd be crazy. But we basically divide our target, right, 600 for our larger container, by the container that sits in, 960, we're going to get 62.5%. And likewise, with our smaller container, we're going to get 30% when we do the same thing. Now, you can get some really crazy numbers here with, like, 10 decimal places. Do not round them. You don't have to. These are computers. They love numbers. They'll run it for you. All you have to do if you're using the calculator on your handy computer is hit Control-C, and it just copies whatever value you want and just pastes it right into your style sheet. So when we create our style sheet, we're going to replace those pixel values with these percentage widths. That's it. That's a flexible grid. You're changing the way that you're thinking about the layout of your site from a fixed pixel width or even a relative but mostly fixed M width to instead a fluid percentage-based layout. So what you have instead is you have a large container that's 100%, you have a 30% smaller container and a 62.5% larger container, and they scale nicely on all that. Make sense? So the second little element of responsive design are flexible images, right? Because now you've got images on your page. Well, wait a minute, I edited this in Photoshop and it's 340 pixels wide because that's what they told me to make it. What are we going to do now? Oh my goodness. It's okay. There's a really easy CSS rule that fixes a lot of those problems. And that's just tell all of your images to be maximum size 100%. What that does is it says never make an image larger than its container. So an image will stay the size of its container, but as the container itself shrinks, the image will shrink as well. This is a trick that's been around for a long time. Now, I should point out that there's a slight caveat to that. If you are doing a really heavy image-based site, you do want to be somewhat careful about sending down lots and lots of images that are enormously huge in case you have somebody visiting you on a, you know, an internet-enabled TV to a small device. Not necessarily because we say, oh, it might be on a 3G network, although that's certainly the case, but you don't need to send a 2,000 pixel wide image to a tiny phone, right? So there's a lot of fuss and hullabaloo and grandstanding going on right now in the web governance community about how to solve this problem. So there are a lot of ways out there, and we'll talk about some of them later on. Easy little polyfills that you can use for now that will fix some of these problems. My guess is most libraries are not pretty image heavy, unless you're actually like a library of images. So there are ways around it. The third and final pillar are CSS3 media queries. How many people here are familiar with CSS? Okay, good. So we're gonna get our hands dirty later. We're gonna do some code. It's gonna be fun, but I will walk you through it. So don't be scared if you don't know code. We're gonna walk through it all. But basically, CSS3 media queries are part of the new CSS3 spec, and they allow you to make some of your styles conditional based on certain attributes, either screen width, or you can use devices, you can do all kinds of different things with them. But for our purposes, we're going to basically just focus on screen width, because that's a good way to determine what kind of an experience you need to have for your user, since the whole point of device sniffing and browser sniffing is to figure out how big the screen is so you can send the appropriately sized thing, right? So why not just figure out what the screen size is, and then you don't have to worry. As long as the device has a screen, you're going to be good. If it doesn't have a screen, you should ask why your users are coming there. There are
things without screens, right? Screen readers, things like that, and we'll talk about it. So here's a couple of things we can think about. We have some pretty common devices we can look at here. Ignore some of these don't make any sense to you, but that's okay.
320 pixels is the width of an iPhone in portrait mode. 480 pixels is an iPhone in landscape. 7-inch tablets at the Kindle Fire are 600 pixels in portrait. 768 pixels will get you, or 10-inch tablets in portrait, like the iPad. 1,024 pixels are 10-inch tablets in landscape, and the, quote, desktop world is often a target. Figure most people have with the 1024 screen. So these are just some ideas of like where we might want to start thinking about approaching how to break up this screen. Now, as we'll learn later, don't get married to these numbers, okay? Because we're gonna talk about some strategies for how to come up with the best breakpoint for your project. Oh, that's very dark. Is there a light? Can you see it okay? No. Okay. Well, we need to find a way. Are there light switches back there?
We could have a group project. Oh, magical. Okay.
Excuse me while I read the directions. What scene do you think is good?
Ocean
It says scene four. That sounds pretty nice. I don't, is it doing anything? Push buttons 1 through 6 for lighting changes. I really wish I was giving a talk on writing. Documentation.
Well, I'm gonna just I'm gonna pantomime the slide for you. What I've got here is actually just a photograph of my whiteboard in my office when we were planning on a project. It's got several breakpoints for our responsive project we were working on, and we just drew out in all these different configurations where all the content is going to go. Right. So we start down here. For those of you who can maybe sort of see it, we have a 320 pixel wide sort of very small screen idea with all of our content, and then we're rearranging the content to adapt to the different screen sizes. You can see the full glory of this in the slides that you, your commemorative edition, which you can download from the computer internet afterwards. Once we figure out how we want stuff to appear, we're going to actually just type it all right into our style sheet. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to have our base style. So there are lots of ways to do this. This is the way I recommend doing it. Your base style, sort of whatever the smallest device that's going to come to your website is going to be. We're going to put all those styles just normally, because they're going to load for every device. And then after those, we're going to progressively load styles for larger screens. So this media query right up here says, if we're dealing with a screen, right, since this is not going to work for print, and the minimum width of the screen is 480 pixels, show these styles. If the width is set 479, it will ignore all the styles after that, and it'll just show the base style. But as soon as we hit 480, it's going to load the styles in that little query. And we're going to move up to 600, 768, whatever your breakpoints might be. You can load all these queries just dependent on screen size. That's it. I mean, that's what happens when you do it.
This is our new website, actually.
Proud to show you.
I'm making an assumption that you actually want to know more, so we're just going to keep going. And I think the best way to do this is actually to get our hands dirty, right? To build a website together. Well, I already built it, but we'll walk through how we might go ahead and build it. An hour and a half is not enough time to build a website live. But
so here's our good friend, the librarian, a library or librarian library, the LOL library. And we've got a lot of stuff here. We've got a nice search box that's going to be able to search for all kinds of stuff. We've got our navigation up there to get to different parts of our website. We've got events. We're advertising. We've got some news, right? And we've got what appear to be some exhibits down here that we're going to be advertising as well.
The site itself, you know, sort of a nice grid layout.
Sort of three big chunky columns, if you think about it. Looking pretty terrific.
But people might visit that site on smaller screens. So we're going to think about how are we going to present some of this content on smaller screens. So here we've got maybe iPad portrait-ish size. We're going to have our exhibit sort of front and center, because those are going to have really great images, probably, of all the cool stuff that we're showing. Not maybe in this case. Although the stuffy LOLs looks pretty awesome. I mean, it's got Ranganathan's EpiPen. I mean, you want to go to that, right? We're going to have our news over in the sidebar. And we're going to drop the events down below the news. Same content. We're not hiding any content from anybody because they have a smaller screen. We're not going to punish them for having a different place, right? We're going to give them all the content that they want, all the content everybody else gets. We're just going to display it for them in an appropriate manner for their device. Now, what about somebody on a Kindle Fire or even smaller screen, right? They're not going to be able to read some of that text very easily without zooming, so we're going to have another layout for them where we're going to put the news front and center. We're going to have our events. We're going to have our exhibits. I hope nobody needed Dramamine for that. And then, you know, we have a slightly different layout now. This is a little bit more of a, you know, bigger lift, but we're still getting everything readable and all the content is available. But that's still not going to solve the problem for people with phones, right?
So we're going to create a new layout for them as well. Where we're going to have our search right at the top still. The navigation, you'll notice, is missing. So there's this mysterious menu button up in the corner. We're going to have our news. We're going to have our events, again, our exhibits. Our navigation is going to reappear at the bottom, and then we're going to have our footer. Magic. We should have a uniform slide here, I think.
Here's a little video of it in action. Sorry, we don't have popcorn. But this
sort of shows you how it works. The browser is going to actually just respond to all these media queries on the fly as the screen is resized if you're in the desktop features.
And one thing to think about is, for a long time we have thought about, you know, oh, well, we know the width of the user's screen because we're, you know, we see the analytics of, oh, they came here with a 1024 by 768 pixel resolution screen, right? So what we've done is we said that screen size is what people are looking at our website on. So how many of you resize websites to fit things, right? We have no idea in our analytics what the browser window size is. So this still will help out in certain cases where people want to resize the window, they still want to get to all your content.
That's why you don't want to hide things, right? Because somebody could be on a desktop machine and they could resize the window really small because they want them to see, you know, your hours or whatever while they're doing something else. And if you start taking away things from them, they're going to lose that functionality. So we want to keep all the content there. We just want to rearrange it for people. As a quick note, if you have content that you think to yourself, you know, they probably don't need that, probably nobody needs it. Just a quick rule of thumb. So, not that libraries ever have too much content. All right, so you can play along at home if you have a .com machine. You can go to lollibrary.org, and the site is live up there. We're going to start building the site by using well-structured HTML. If you use a program like Dreamweaver or other things, they're getting a lot better, so make sure you have a newer version if you're going to build HTML that way. If you read it by hand, you have a lot more control. But either way, we have to think about how this HTML is going to be structured. And one of the things we really want to take into consideration is source order. We want to think about what comes in what place in the source. Because we do have to think about all the possibilities of people coming to our site. So we have to think, people might be coming with a custom style sheet that they've written themselves for every website. There are nerds who might do that. I don't know. You might have people who just have a device that's not capable of loading any style sheet. Maybe an old Nokia phone or something. A lot of this is going to depend on your audience, so you're going to have to take some of that into consideration. But primarily, one thing to remember is that people come to your site for the content. But what is the number one thing that we put right after the title of our library on our website? Probably all of it. Navigation. Who comes to a website for navigation? Nobody. They come in for the content, right? The navigation helps you get to that content, but we make people wade through content or through navigation if they don't have, you know, CSS to display it in a particular way before they can get to the actual content. So we've gotten around this in the past by putting little links that say, like, skip the content, right, or for screen readers, so they can get past all the navigation. If you have a lot of navigation and a screen reader has to go through it, oh boy, it's going to be a long wait for somebody
to sit there and listen to all the different, you know, specific vendor terms and cool names we've given our search boxes. We call one of ours Nautilus to contact. Anyway. So we're going to think about this on our site. And one way that'll help us sort of understand why we need to think about this is the idea that layout is an enhancement. Now, we've talked for a long time since CSS really became popular at the mainstream, I guess, in about 2002, when Wired was redesigned to use web standards and no longer had a table-based layout. We've said you've got to separate content and styles, right? Right? Layout should not be a part of the actual semantic part of the web page. You need to have your HTML all separate. And then after that, you need to have your styles that'll do all the layout. But we really didn't do a great job of this because we were still kind of building our HTML based on, well, I want the navigation to be at the top. So I'm going to put it at the top of the page in the source order because I don't know how to get it there if it's not in that spot, right, in the source order. But if we think about layout as an enhancement, right, that we want to serve up usable content to everybody, regardless of what device they have, even if they're just going to see basic, straight, plain, old vanilla HTML, and that we're going to enhance their experience depending on the capabilities of their device, then we can see a better way to think about separating style and content, right? Because we can actually just make the content, just plain old content,
and put it in the order that you would put it if you were printing it out on a piece of paper for somebody to read. Right? What's the most important thing you want them to see on your website? For an academic blogger, it's probably a search box.
So let's think about layout as an enhancement. So here's our website with no styles, but with source order. So what we have is we have our heading, we've got our search box, we've got our news, we've got our events, we've got our exhibits, we've got our navigation down here, and we've got our footer. Navigation as an ordered list, you can make it an unordered list. I guess I don't really think that there's any difference. But think about this idea of just put your content first. So I know you came here to hear us talk about design, but really this is about content, right? We're trying to figure out how to show our content more appropriately to all of our users. So we have to think about getting the content out there first. And a lot of times, that means doing things differently than we've done in the past. So here's our content. If you look at a structure, we've got our H1, right, our largest heading that's going to be the name of our library. We've got a form element that's going to be our search box. We've got a couple of sections. I'm using HTML5 section tags here. You can use divs. You can use whatever you're most comfortable with. I just like sections. I think they're more generic. So we've got our news, we've got our events, and we've got our exhibits. For those who don't know, the pound sign before a label like this indicates that it's an ID. So you can assign specific IDs to HTML elements within a document, which you can then reference from CSS, and it'll only work on a particular ID. So we've given these the news, the events, and the exhibits ID. And they also have a semantic meaning. That is also something that can tell exactly what that particular section is doing. Then we've got our nav, our navigation. I'm using a nav element, but you can use anything you like. And then our footer at the bottom. So that's the source order. That's how people are going to read it if they don't have the ability to load CSS. Here's a wonderful shot just to scare everybody. The HTML.
And if you want to code along at home, you can grab all the code for this at github.mrisma.lol.
And these slides will be online too, and of course the talk, so if you want to write all this stuff down later, you can. But if you want to grab it now and play along as we're going through things, that's great. So we have our content. It's awesome, but we need to make it look a little bit better. So a little bit more on grids here.
There's a couple ways you can do this. If you're designing a site from scratch, you can actually think of this in terms of percentages from the get-go. But a lot of us don't have the time or maybe the resources to do a full-on redesign of things. And also, anyone who's ever done this before knows that that's 90% a political job. So maybe you don't want to do that. You want to convert your existing site to a responsive design. Really, all you need to do is you first need to think, is this really grid based? I might need to make some tweaks to make it a little bit more grid and fluid. And you can actually go through your CSS file and find all of your elements that are pixel-based widths and just convert them all to percentages by using a handy-dandy formula and your best friend the calculator. So you can convert existing designs to responsive design by simply switching over to these percentage-based widths. You might have to make some other tweaks, but you know what I mean. You're going to have to figure out those other layouts, right, when you get the smaller screens, because those aren't built in. But you probably have a desktop layout, and you can start with that. And you can use, if it's easier to convert, you can actually use a max width query. So you can say, instead of going minimum width, so you're showing the very basic style first and then growing as the screen gets larger, you can do it the other way around if you want. Put your sort of quote-unquote desktop styles first, and then load max width queries that will essentially overwrite some of those existing styles as the screen. So these are all strategies depending on how you're actually going to get,
what the next step is for you at your institution. So we want to get from pictures of our design, right, whether you've made them in Photoshop, which you can do. You can make multiple designs for different screen sizes in Photoshop. There's a great notebook called the Responsive Design Sketchbook that I have. It's a big thing. It's like, overpriced sketchbook of graph paper that's sort of broken into different breakpoints for you. Or you can just use graph paper or a whiteboard. Just, sketch up your designs. Just do it rough that way. You can do it in Photoshop, or you can build them in the browser.
That's what I do a lot of times. And you're going to probably do a combination of both. So you're going to get into the browser even if you have a bunch of pixel based layouts from Photoshop that you're converting to responsive design, you're going to get in the browser and realize, you know, when you get to this point, it looks really stupid, and you're going to have to do a little bit of tweaking in the browser. And that's okay.
It's fun to do. All right, so we're dealing with our content first. And in my mind, to me, that is best thought of as mobile first. Right?
So we're going to think about the base user, the base style experience that we're going to give to be the style that we would normally call our mobile style. Right? So something that's designed for a phone. Now, all the CSS I'm going to show here is just going to be based on layout. We're going to, if you look at the code, I split up the styles into a style sheet, which is going to cover typography and colors and those types of things, and then a separate layout style sheet so that just so it's easier to see the distinction between them. So you don't have to do that. It's probably good to keep everything in one sheet so you're not hitting a server multiple times for every load. But as we go through this style, just keep in mind I'm only showing the styles relevant to moving things around, essentially, at this point. So if you have any questions about, you know, how does that other style work, you can look at the style sheet, you can raise your hand, you can shoot me an email later, or hit me on Twitter, or I'll be here afterwards if you can talk. So. Okay, so here's our mobile design we showed earlier. If we think about what are the attributes of this particular design, what we see is that pretty much everything all the way down to a block element. Everybody familiar with the difference between inline and block elements in CSS? Inline element means that it's in line with something else. So if you have an image that's inline, and you put text right next to it, it's going to appear next to the image as opposed to below it. If you have a block level element, it treats itself like a big block that makes anything else after that comes after it essentially down to the next line, unless you do something other things to move it around. So we've got block elements, the navigation's at the bottom, but that's in our source order, so that's okay. And we've got this mysterious menu button, which is actually an anchor link that will take you down to that navigation. So that you, it's sort of a little way to allow the mobile user not to scroll all the way to the bottom or figure out where that menu is to get them down there. There are a million design patterns for solving this problem of navigation cluttering up your whole screen. Because if we did actually have this showing at the very top, then when you load this on a phone, all you'd see was navigation, right? The whole entire site would just be navigation. We don't want that. There's a lot of ways to do it. This is just one.
So we want to get this into our styles. So here's basically a little,
it looks very light bright.
but here's kind of the our styles right now, right? We've got section elements, we've got the navigation element, we've got the footer element. These are all automatically block elements.
So we don't have to do a lot with those for layout because they're already going to act like blocks, right? They're by default going to be the width of their containing element, which is 100% because we haven't put them in anything else, except for the body element. The inputs, those are inline elements that we're going to need to tell to be blocks if we want to display like this. And we've got a heading and an anchor that are sitting next to each other, so we need to figure out how are we going to get those sitting next to each other because the heading is a block element, right? So we have to tell it to behave in some way more like an inline element. And that's easy, right? We can use the magic of our formula. So we're going to float our heading left, and we're going to make it 66% of the screen. So it's going to be 2/3 of the screen. And then in the header, we've got this little div that has a class of no mean, which is a not as semantic as it should be way to say no medium. So a lot of times I'll use classes like no small, no mean, or no big to say these are little tiny things that are generally helped for people on particular screen sizes. They're not essential content, but we're going to hide them based on screen sizes. Don't do that with your content. You can do it with little things like this is an anchor link that's just going to get me to the bottom. Once the navigation's at the top, putting an anchor link there is kind of silly, so we're going to hide that. We're going to float that to the right, and we're going to make it 33%. So 66 and 33, 99. You can put in all your decimals just to keep the screen from looking too crazy. I took them out here, but you could put in 66.66667, and so on.
So what we're going to end up is this little header right here. Now, there's a couple little things that I want to show you here, and I did these sort of differently so I can show you. We have a little padding left on the header because we don't want it to butt up against the side of the screen. So we want to like just shift it over slightly. And I use padding here because padding the margins work differently when you're calculating responsive design. So for the padding, I wanted it to move over one percentage
of the entire width of the screen. But when you calculate the padding of an element, the context is not the containing element, but the element itself. So, it's a little confusing, but if you're familiar with the box model, I said that and no one ran out the door yet. Oh, a couple people. So people freak out about the box model. But if you think about padding, is the padding in relationship to the element you're talking about, right? So think of it this way. Like, if I'm going to put on a Santa Claus suit, right? Somebody says, put on a Santa Claus suit and stand 4 feet from the wall. Well, the padding, I need to add some bulk to myself, right? So that's going to be in relation to me. This is a terrible metaphor. Think of that as padding, right? I mean, we can call it padding, right? Maybe a little padding here. And then 4 feet from the wall, well, we'd say, you know, 20% of the width of the room, I guess, since we're going to be official here about our percentages, that's going to be the margin, right? So that's in relation to the whole room. So margin, our context, is the containing element, but padding, the context, is the element itself. So if I want to make it 1%, I have these moments whenever I do this where I'm pretty sure I did my math wrong here, so because all those people who love math can tell me that I'm wrong. But I want it to be 1% of the entire width of the body, because that's the padding we're going to use for the rest of the elements. I want them all to line up. But if I do 1%, I'm going to be doing 1% of 65%. Right? So I need to figure out, how do I make 1% of the 100%? So I have to do the math, which took me a really long time, and I'm sure it's wrong, to be able to get that padding. So if the padding is going to be a different value than your margin when you do things, right? Because you're thinking about this stuff in relation. But now you also notice that we're going to adapt our other values to accommodate for those paddings. If you have a width of 66 and then you add padding, you've now made it 67 or 58 or whatever your padding is. So you're actually increasing the size. And so you're going to end up with all kinds of problems where things aren't going to float nicely next to each other because they're too wide for the screen. Alright.
So now to get our inputs looking like blocks, we've got our text and our submit. We're going to make them both display block. And we're going to add some margins to match them and some padding on this text one. And the padding on the text is actually so that the text itself inside the input just doesn't bump up against the edge of the input. So you'll notice that in order to do that, because I do have padding and margins on the text block, but I want it to be the same width total, appear to be the same width as a submit, the widths themselves are different to accommodate for the padding on the text. Okay? So there's a lot of weird math going on here. And trust me, you will hit your head against the wall a couple times when you're trying to figure all this stuff out. Does this make sense?
Sure.
Any questions? Okay. So I used to teach philosophy, so I'm used to looking out at a room with people going, huh? So I will ask if you guys are all on board here.
Why is it mixed and is it percentage?
Ah, that's a great transition, Eric, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Another person from my Twitter. We'll get to that in just a moment. So what we're going to do, I couldn't have actually paid Eric to do this at a better time. What we want to do is we want to think about enhancing with the size, right? So this way we're setting with small screens and we're building up, as your device is quote unquote more capable of displaying more stuff on a screen, we're going to enhance it. And so we're going to put in our media query and we're going to ask for a minimum width of 33.75 m. So styles at least that wide are going to go there. Well, not Eric, but what's the deal with M, right? What is it? M's allow you to have relative sizes that are more fixed than percentages. Essentially, an M is the term is a carryover from the print days. It's the width of the letter M in whatever particular font. So throughout the font, an M remains consistent, but an M in 14-point Georgia is going to be different from an M in 26-point Comic Sans. Does that make sense? So the M's themselves are relative within their font stack, but not relative outside the other font stack. Whereas if you have 20% and 20% something, well, the idea of 20%, even though the physical size will be different, is going to be the same. That probably doesn't make sense. But anyway, M's, what they do in real terms, is allow your user to use that little zoom button. Now, I know we all work in libraries, so I know you've all dealt with this, you know. People zoom their screen way in, and then I can't find this thing, you know, way off on the
14 feet to the left. So what you want to do is, if you're doing everything in pixels, right? So you're doing your media queries in pixels. If you zoom the screen in, pixels do not change. So your media query has just changed. It's thinking that the screen is a different size than it is, so it's going to freak out. If you use M's, M's are relative across the board, so it gives you a way to keep the layout fixed and allow you to zoom better. It's also just a nice way to nice chicken. So M's are good. They're your friend. Now in general, 1M you can say equals 16 pixels in most browsers. There's a little caveat here. The caveat is you probably need to load a reset style sheet to reset all the styles on your page, because every browser does things a little bit differently. So if you haven't heard of a reset style sheet, I am running one on the LOL library site, so you can check that out. You can find a reset style sheet generator at Eric Meyer's site. You just Google CSS reset, you'll get the generator. And basically what it does is it just sets everything to like width 100%, clears all the padding and margins. You will have to style things like paragraphs, headings, because all the headings will look exactly the same, but it starts you from a base so that you can't, you know, if you try to do a layout in Firefox and IE, and you can't figure out why something's not working, it could be because IE thinks that an H1 should by default have, you know, 5 pixels of padding here, whereas another browser has to get a 4. And that 1 pixel can make all the difference. And you will spend all day trying to figure it out, and you will hate IE.
Yeah. So you have to sort of think about this. When you start off from scratch, you're generally working with 1n equals 16 pixels. Now, one caveat. When you declare the width or dimensions of something in m, then 1m inside of that changes to become relative to the width of the element relation. So your m will change throughout your layout, and that will also drive you a little crazy. But because in responsive design, most of our widths, the widths are really where the problems come to play, and widths are generally percentages, so you don't have to worry so much about the headache that causes. But so if you declare in the header, if anybody's looking at the source code or looking at the style, if you declare in your header and you say font size, header font size 2m, all the text that appears in the header element is going to be 2m. Tall, right, which will be roughly 20 or 32 pixels. See, that math. And then if you, inside of the header, if you have an H1, and you say H1 size 5M, and you think I'm making this 160 pixels, because 1M is 16, right? You told the browser that everything inside the header element should be 2M. So inside the header element, 1M now equals 32 pixels. Does that make sense? So that's the kind of place you have to sort of just watch out for that kind of stuff. But that's totally beyond the scope of the stuff. All right. Just remember, relative M's are relative.
So when we're looking at this particular query, we have 33.75M. That's roughly 540 pixels.
And I know, again, there's a little caveat, right? Depends on if you have a reset style sheet or other stuff.
So now you're asking yourself, well, what device is 540 pixels wide? Well, there isn't one. Don't think about this in terms of devices, right?
Because devices are going to change, and you're going to end up with the same problem you had when you were device sniffing and when you were browser sniffing. You cannot keep up with different device books.
It's not about the device at all. What it is it's about your content.
So base your breakpoints and your queries on the content that you have in your site.
The best way to tell where to put a breakpoint, when your site looks stupid.
You call this math law, your site starts to look stupid, put a breakpoint in
there. All right, so now that we're enhancing with size, we're going to see what we're going to do now that we've got up to 33 3/4 m. So the form moves up to the header right. The navigation magically flies up to the top. And there's an anchor link to the navigation and the header that disappears. So what we have is, here's our old layout. And through the magic of light bright animation or something, we rearrange things a little bit to look like this.
Getting rid of that menu button is really easy.
Display, none.
Poof, it's gone.
The rest of it's a little trickier. We want to move our heading over a little bit, and we're going to put the, instead of that menu button, we're going to put our search box up there. And so we're going to change some of the widths. Now, notice I'm not floating the first heading over, because I already floated it in the base style. All those base styles are inherited into your media query. So the only time you need to add additional styles as you increase sizes is when you want to do something differently than you did before. So the width before was 66%, or roundabouts, and I want to make it smaller, so I'm going to just change the width to 32. It's already floating, so we don't have to add that additional style. It's already there. The form, we're going to float left, so that both of those elements are going to go over to the left, and we're going to make that 66%. The 1% difference accounts for a little bit of padding on the header? I can't remember. So it's either padding or margin on the header. Whichever one it is, that's where the 32% comes from. Not really at all. Now, one thing we need to do is our inputs are block elements, so they're sitting on top of each other. But we don't necessarily need to change any inline elements, although we could. We can just declare widths and float them, because you can just float block elements all you want. So we're going to float them around, and now we have this magical heading with our inputs. So I'm floating the submit button to the right. You don't need to do that. I just like how it looks a little bit better. And the 28%, you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't divide by 3 into 100, right? So where is this crazy percentage coming from? This is one of those little things where you just play with it until it looks right. Sometimes you have to do it. All right, so navigation is a trickier one. This is a little tip. I mean, I've done a lot of different ways to get navigation to move around, including absolute positioning and all kinds of stuff. But this is actually a way that works back to CSS2. So this is pretty much every browser that's going to come visit you will actually play nice with this method. What you do is you just tell the body to display itself as a table. You say that the navigation is going to be the table caption. And up there, the caption side is top. And basically what it does is it flips the navigation to the top of the screen and displays it as the caption of the entire table, which is the body or the containing element of all your stuff. Now, I've done a little bit of positioning to get it down off the actual top, but you can put it at the top, like, you know, Twitter has its full bar at the top, things like that. And basically what we're going to do is go through our navigation list and tell it to behave like a table. We don't use actual tables in HTML, but you can tell things to act like tables in CSS. And it's sort of magical. This idea came from a great article by Jeremy Keith, who's a developer in the UK, Brighton, I want to say. And he writes at adoptio.com. Also, you should definitely follow him if you don't know. His stuff is great. So, everybody on board? Okay. Once we get to 43 and 3/4 M's, we're going to move our news and events to the right column, and our exhibits are going to appear in the left column. Right? Everything else. Not much else is changing in that. So what we've got here is these are moving over and our exhibits sort of take up the prime real estate. One little trick I use in this was I wrapped the two elements that will be in the right column in a separate div with a specific ID so that I could control them both identically. And I'm going to basically start wrapping these in the right column div, these two sections, and then we're going to float them to the right. So we're floating the whole right column to the right and making it 30%. Now previously in our media queries, the news and event sections were set to 100%. So they're already going to obey this because now they're in a containing element that is only 30%. So they will be 100% of 30%. They're also going to be 30%. We don't need to change them at all. And the exhibits we're going to also float to the right, so sort of piggyback right on the other stuff. And we're going to make those 66%. Magic, right? We're getting this. That's not a lot of changes for one layout in the screen, right? That was just a couple lines of CSS. So now once you get up to like 64M, which is more for their traditional desktop and size, we're going to move our news and events actually across the top. The news will be in sort of one third of the screen, and then events will be in two thirds. Exhibits will be below in three columns. And the heading actually changes. I don't know if anybody's noticed this yet. The heading changes to the full name. So at full size, it says library or librarian library. And at smaller sizes, it says LOL library. I'll show you how you can do little tricks like that. So here's what we're looking at doing. Events moves up, exhibits moves down.
We need to overwrite the cells we just set on that right column. So we're not going to float it anymore. Right? We're going to get rid of the margins, and we're going to set the width now to 100%. So instead of 30, we're now at 100. The events, we don't want it to come below anything else. Because right now it's clearing the news, so we don't want it to clear the news, which means it can float up next to it. We're going to set the width of that to 2/3. So now we have news taking up 1/3 of the screen, and events taking up the rest with the news styles at the bottom. Inside of the events, we've got these two events that are stacked on top of each other in all of our previous styles. We want them to get side by side. So we have a div wrapping each of the images or the sections. We're just going to float those together. Add a little bit of margin, and now we've got nice images side by side. Exhibits are going to do basically the same thing. We want it to spread across the entire bottom of the screen, so we're going to set that at 100%. And then we're going to break it up into three more columns, and we're going to float those all to the left. Now, it's got a weird width here. This is one of those instances where you look at a lot of different browsers, and you got to make sure everything's lining up, because people are going to be finicky about some of the rounding. 31.3% works great. Now, here's my favorite little trick. This is the HTML for our H1, our top heading, right? So what we have is we have an abbreviation tag, which gives a title, so that if somebody comes on a screen reader or they hover their mouse over the abbreviation, it'll tell them what that abbreviation means. It's a great accessibility thing you should do with all your abbreviations. Not that libraries have a lot of abbreviations. But so we're showing the LOL and the title of library or librarian. But we're also including the full title here in a span. So the worst case scenario, if somebody comes to our site that have no CSS, they're going to see the title LOL, library or librarian library. I don't think that's too bad. I'm okay with that. But if they do have CSS, what we'll do within our base files, we'll just hide the span, right? We're going to hide that full title. So they're only going to see the abbreviation. And then once we get up to 64 M's, we'll just basically switch. We'll hide the abbreviation, and we're going to just display the span. It's easy. You can do this with all kinds of fun things. We've done it with Grand Valley State University Library. Slightly long title. If we actually had that across the top bar, it would be like, you know, 6-point font, or actually thick. So we truncate GVSU Library. We're going to get on a smaller screen by using spans. So we're just getting ready for the exciting question and answer portion of the period. But I do want to talk a little bit about support. I know that's foremost in everybody's mind. What browsers does this work in? So CSS3 media queries are supported in pretty much all modern browsers. And by modern browsers, I mean everything in IE 9 and up. And everybody just cringed in the room. They're like, oh, I'm still supporting IE 4. And then they work in WebKit, I think Safari 2 and up, and anybody know the, it's a lot. So IE doesn't work very well for a lot of the Internet Explorer that we're dealing with, probably 7 and 8, a lot of, hopefully not 6. If you have 6, you have my eternal sympathy. But most of us are probably still fighting with 7 and 8. But there's a way to get around it. This is something that's being argued a little bit about in basically the governance committees for the WPC that are setting a lot of the new standards for browsers, figuring out what the best way to do this is. But in the meantime, Scott Jail, I don't know how to say his last name, smart guy on the internet, I think, about responsive design, has this great little, what he calls a polyfill, that sort of patches this missing capability of browsers. And it's a 1 kilobyte JavaScript file that will patch non-supporting browsers to use media queries. So basically, it just looks for window resizes, and then it reads your CSS file and patches that CSS in your mind. So it works great. Does live updating in IE, and the overhead, you can't beat it, 1K, right? I mean, it's a tiny, tiny file. So you can get around some of these limitations. Alternatively, you may have to accept the fact that some of your browsers are going to see that mobile style, right? So that base style, that's why you want that base style. You want to make sure that it's easy to use and that all of your content is in there, visible for everybody, so that if they can't load the media queries, they can still get your content. Remember, layout is an enhancement.
The second question I get asked all the time is, okay, this is great. I don't like my calculator. How can I do this in 15 minutes? There are some cheats, okay? You're not going to do it in 15 minutes. But there are a couple of frameworks you can use. There's Twitter Bootstrap. A lot of you have probably heard of that. It's a framework that'll also work as sort of a UI pattern reference. So there's all kinds of goodies in there, from, you know, setting up menus to look particular ways, do all kinds of things, but everything's responsive. So you can basically include Twitter Bootstrap in your project. Eric, did you use Bootstrap for something?
No.
Somebody used Bootstrap for something. I can't remember what it was. But it's just a way you can sort of kind of jumpstart the development process. You'll probably need to tweak it for your own installation. Right? Do some tweaks, but at least you've got a good start. And there's another one called Foundation, which is kind of a little bit like Bootstrap-like. So it takes all the responsive parts of Bootstrap, essentially, and puts those in, and then you don't have to deal with all the other stuff that a lot of people don't use. Twitter itself uses Bootstrap to build Twitter, so your website will look a little bit like Twitter's website if you use it out of the box. Okay, so now the third question is, well, where are the libraries that are doing this?
There aren't a lot that are live yet. There are a lot of people who say, we're building a responsive site, it'll be live in 2017.
When the dean retires.
But there are a couple that are going live soon. So the Canton Public Library in Canton, Michigan, has their site. It's been responsive now for a couple of months. He sort of quietly snuck this in. That's one. And he's got a very different way of handling the navigation on the top, as you can see. In addition, the University of Virginia Library, this is actually still in preview, but I think it goes live in a couple weeks. And they did say that I could show this here. Their site is now responsive. And that's, you can see it at preview.lib.virginia.edu. University-wide, Notre Dame, responsive to their whole site. Grand Valley, my institution, our library hasn't gone yet because I was so enthusiastic about responsive design that I convinced our university web team to do it, so now we all have to wait until they go, which is not long. We're going to go live, I think, the same day, actually, that Princeton goes live. With our entire university, it will be responsive, so everything will go. Trying to think of some other ones. There's a lot of others that are in development that people beg me not to show anybody. So I've seen a few others, but probably a half dozen. But it's starting to catch on because there's a lot of reasons you might want to do this at your library besides it just being sort of smart from the get mobile people a better experience, right? There's the staff time issue. Right? You don't have to maintain either two totally separate sets of content in some cases where people are building a separate mobile site and then they have to maintain it here and there. You know, you switch one vendor and then it's, oh great, there was my afternoon switching links from the mobile website and switching this and here, or cancel a database. Heck, never causes any problem. So it just cuts back because you're dealing with a single code base, right? You've just got one set of content and you're working your way through that by changing its look.
You don't have the horrible problem of redirecting people to a mobile site and then maybe having them share that mobile link with one of their friends, and then their friend goes to it, and then it's like on the mobile, but they're on a desktop computer, and they're like, well, where's all the functions, and I can't find it. Or even better, somebody is on a phone, and their professor emails them a link on your library website, and they click on it, and it redirects them to the mobile site, but not actually the mobile version of the page they got, just the mobile site. Now they have to try to find stuff. That kind of stuff is a nightmare for redirection. So this avoids all those problems by having a single URL for every, you know, same URL, you don't have different mobile URLs, you cut back on staff time. It's kind of a, I think it's sort of a no-brainer. If you're just thinking about it from a purely workflow standpoint, it's going to save you a lot of time. Plus, it's super fun. I mean, who doesn't like to just sit in their office and go like, wee, with Windows, right? this is our new workflow. Pardon?
Yeah.
Well, it's because the screen is wider.
It's got
the
rainbow.
Yeah. At smaller screens, we show the horn, and we take away the rainbow. So that's it for the talk. I
love to take questions or have a conversation or hang around and chat or whatever you guys want to do. Are there any questions?